The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In August of 1994, the tail end of the Whitewater controversy in Washington, D.C., competed with the Major League Baseball strike for newspaper headlines nationally. Though not known at the time, since the numbers for the year had yet to be crunched, the entirety of 1994 was also on the verge of a nationwide phenomenon. It was the beginning of a long, steady decline in crime, particularly violent crime, such as physical assault and homicide. This downward trend in crime lasted up until around 2015. Had the nation known, it would have been a welcomed headline for a year of seemingly endless political scandal and the loss of America's favorite pastime. These crime statistics were true in El Paso, Texas, too. Contrary to the myth that U.S. cities that share a border with Mexico are high crime cities, most in fact are not. Crime in El Paso in 1994 was significantly lower than the national average, and remains so today. This, of course, includes homicide. That fact, along with the city's rich cultural diversity and the majestic beauty of the West Texas desert, makes El Paso desirable to many. But the city in August of 1994 did see one of the most horrendous crimes it had in many years, the annihilation of a family, the perpetration of which was so inhuman, so evil, it shook the entire city to its core. The brutal murders of Francisco Santoni Thornhill, Maria Concepcion Villa, and 3-year-old Dante Santoni Villa. Francisco Santoni Thornhill was born in Punta Arenas, Chile, on July 25, 1935, to parents Luis Santoni Perez and Anna Thornhill. Little is known publicly about the man's childhood, and at some point, those who knew him began referring to him as Frank. When Frank became of working age, he became employed at an American auto parts manufacturer in Chile before transferring to Venezuela and finally to Madison, Connecticut, USA. Frank married his first wife, Maria Teresa, on January 3, 1965, and the couple had 4 children together, 2 sons and 2 daughters. While living in Connecticut, one of the man's daughters would later report, Frank and Maria Teresa were happy. A typical, normal family who maintained close relationships with one another and enjoyed family vacations together. Frank met a man there named Abel Gonzalez, whose auto parts company was located in Mexico. Gonzalez began speaking to Frank about partnering up and opening an auto parts business in El Paso, Texas, and ultimately Frank agreed to the idea. GSK Corporation became official in El Paso on September 25, 1984, and Frank, Maria, and their children were all settled there by 1985, save their oldest daughter, who stayed back to finish college. At this point, Frank was a bigwig, more or less, at 3 separate auto parts companies, GSK Corp, Auto Parts International, and Monza Auto Parts, all through his headquarters at 8811 Kastner Boulevard in El Paso. Along with maintaining these roles came an obligation to socialize heavily with other companies' top decision makers, Frank's potential customers. He and his wife Maria began an incredibly busy social life, schmoozing and wining and dining with both clients Frank wanted to keep, along with clients he hoped to win over. Often, the late nights took the couple across the border to Juarez, Mexico. It was a lot of pressure, no doubt, and not easy to keep up with, and Frank, only briefly, Maria thought, sought help doing so. After Maria found a small bag of cocaine in Frank's wallet, she began monitoring her husband's schedules and habits closely. Luckily, she saw no further signs of substance abuse. After 27 years together, however, in 1992, Maria discovered something that shattered the couple's marriage. Frank was having an affair with another woman. Maria was shocked. It didn't seem characteristic of her husband. The two separated, and Maria stayed in the family home while Frank moved into his girlfriend's house in the Montwood neighborhood. Maria and Frank only spoke after that when he called her to talk with or pass messages along to their children. Maria Concepcion Villa, known as Connie, was a 26-year-old travel agent when she and 57-year-old Frank Santoni Thornhill began their affair. Connie was born on December 8, 1965, to parents Nicholas and Maria Villa in El Paso, where she grew up. Like Frank, little is known publicly about Connie's early life, but by 1992, she'd already given birth to Frank's child, Dante Santoni Villa, who was born on July 20, 1991. She was a great mother by all accounts. Connie did everything she could to keep her boy out of harm's way and smothered Dante with love and affection. Dante was a normal kid who loved Cheerios, playing around the pool, and having friends to the house for sleepovers. He was lively, family later said, and funny. Frank, Connie, and Dante lived in East El Paso in a quiet, upper-middle-class neighborhood near Montwood High School. Their two-story tan stucco home, like every other house there, had a well-maintained and landscaped yard and sat on a cul-de-sac. Though Frank rarely socialized with neighbors, some referring to him as a recluse, Connie and Dante were often seen outside. Dante socialized plenty with other neighborhood children, which Connie encouraged and facilitated. The family, like the neighborhood, was quiet, though, and some said Frank and Connie kept their personal lives private. But they seemed as normal as any other family in El Paso's Montwood neighborhood. In August of 1994, however, the neighborhood became anything but normal, and instead became the scene of an unthinkably savage and shuddering triple murder. On Thursday, August 11th, 1994, at around 10:45 a.m., Connie Villa's sister arrived at Frank and Connie's home to watch 3-year-old Dante so his mother could go to work. When she arrived, the home looked normal from the outside. There were no signs to prepare Connie's sister for what she'd find within. No signs the house had been forcibly entered. When she opened the door, however, it became immediately clear to the woman that something was terribly amiss. The house had been ransacked and was in shambles. It looked like someone had turned over every nook and cranny there they could, looking for something, and it was obvious a great struggle had occurred. She called to her sister, but there was no answer. When she entered the master bedroom looking for Connie, she discovered a bloodbath, a nightmare. On the floor there laid her sister Connie and her sister's husband, Frank, covered in blood. They were both dead. In 3-year-old Dante's bedroom, Connie's sister's living nightmare reached an unimaginable climax when she found the toddler's body there on his bed, also covered in blood. When the El Paso County Medical Examiner performed autopsies on the victims, it was discovered they'd each been stabbed at least 10 times. First responders to the scene of the family annihilation were horrified, as were, of course, El Paso police investigators. Though detectives in the West Texas desert city were far from novices, the severity of the Montwood triple murder scene was something new. It was one of the most violent and seemingly senseless crimes they'd seen. Reconciling a motive for such a brutally perpetrated bloodbath was difficult, and the fact that 3-year-old Dante had met the same brutal end as his parents was impossible to comprehend. Detectives were shaken, no doubt, but they were also angered, extremely motivated to catch the monster who could have inflicted this, the evilest of acts. The investigation began immediately upon detectives arriving at the scene, and a task force of 12 investigators dedicated solely to the case was also immediately formed. El Paso Police Detective Jim Holland called the task force intensive and full-blown. Investigators searched the scene of the murders for clues. No murder weapon had been left behind, however, and items taken from the home only confused the investigation more. The detectives said that the items stolen weren't typical and were virtually valueless from what they could tell. The scene began painting a picture, and a theory of what happened was developed. Though how the perpetrator got into the home was a mystery, they knew that Connie was repeatedly stabbed to death first in the master bedroom, and after that, they thought, the killer entered Dante's bedroom and did the same thing to him. Frank wasn't home, at least not yet. The man had been in Juarez on business, and investigators theorized that after savagely stabbing Connie and Dante, the perpetrator removed articles of clothing and other undisclosed items from the master bedroom closet and loaded them into Connie's Dodge Colt, which was parked in the garage. Then, they speculated, the killer lied in wait for Frank to return. When Frank did return, the killer surprised him in the home's hallway, stabbed him multiple times there, and dragged him to the bedroom where his body was found. The killer then fled the home in Connie's turquoise Dodge Colt, of which a Be on the Lookout was issued immediately. El Paso police detectives interviewed neighbors, but none could report seeing or hearing anything out of the ordinary. Investigators were sure that the murders occurred just as the day turned, at around 12 a.m. on August 11, 1994, and one neighbor did see Frank outside the home a little after midnight, presumably as he returned home from Juarez. A teenager who lived two houses away from Frank, Connie, and Dante reported to police that between 11 p.m. and midnight, he heard their dogs barking, but the three canines, according to him, were always barking, so he didn't think anything about it. On Monday, August 15th, Connie's turquoise Dodge Colt was found near the intersection of Durango Street and West Paisano in South El Paso. The location of the abandoned vehicle, perhaps, told a story in itself, as it was found less than a half a mile from the Texas-Mexico border. Inside the car, investigators found receipts that had been given to Connie long before she, Dante, and Frank were murdered, along with some articles of her clothing on the floorboard, a Dillard's hosiery club card, and a Luis Miguel cassette tape. There were no signs of the killer, or at least no clues left by the killer, were made public. El Paso detectives struggled to find a motive for the massacre, but, as per standard procedure, they started looking at those closest to the victims. Upon discovering Frank was initiating divorce proceedings from his estranged wife, Maria Teresa, she seemed like as good a place as any for investigators to start. The crime seemed much too brutal for Maria to have perpetrated, and anyway, she was quickly ruled out, along with other family members on both sides. El Paso Police Sergeant Bill File said, however, that he believed either Frank, Connie, or both knew their murderer, and for good reason. In an overwhelming majority of homicides, that is indeed the case. Sergeant File even likened gang violence as such a crime, since whether or not a perpetrator and victim personally knew each other, the gangs are undoubtedly familiar with one another. But the murder of a family in their home, and so brutally, so seemingly personal in some way, was far from a drive-by shooting. It wasn't even in the same ballpark. When detectives had no other place to look, they began theorizing that perhaps Frank's murder was related to his work, and Connie and three-year-old Dante were simply caught in the crossfire. Not long after Frank Santoni Thornhill and Connie Villa were stabbed to death in their home in El Paso's Montwood neighborhood, alongside their three-year-old son, Dante, Frank's business partner, Abel Gonzalez, lawyered up. The man who was the president of the three corporations in which Frank ran from his El Paso office hired attorney Gary Weiser to represent him. The attorney said his client had nothing to do with the family murders. Though they didn't say they suspected Gonzalez as a person of interest or even a co-conspirator in the slayings, detectives with the El Paso Police Department thought that perhaps the man knew something. A lead had come investigators' way that suggested Frank might have been involved in illegal business activities and got in over his head. If they could get Gonzalez to open up, detectives thought, he might be able to provide the most viable lead. But apparently, after retaining counsel, the man was not cooperating. Years after the murders, too, when the case was long cold, a man jailed in Juarez, Mexico, claimed to have information about the violent deaths of Frank, Connie, and Dante. But after traveling to Mexico and interviewing the incarcerated man, El Paso police detective Michael Amon determined that the details he provided didn't at all match the evidence. Though that was a dead end, investigators were still convinced, even years later, that Abel Gonzalez could provide them with the information they needed to solve the case, though precisely why they think that has never been fully elaborated upon. Gonzalez still refuses to speak with police about the murders and is thought to have moved back to Mexico. The El Paso police followed every lead they got well into 1995, including numerous background checks of individuals and convening a grand jury where witnesses were subpoenaed to testify, until those leads were exhausted. Outside agencies were brought in to help as well. Authorities, however, maintain no clear motive, but theorize that the slayings involved some sort of illegal business dealings, perhaps drug-related, presumably because Gonzalez lawyered up, as did other unnamed business associates of Frank. Even with such a theory at the top of the list, law enforcement could not rule out robbery as the motivating factor. Whatever the motive, El Paso Police Sergeant Pete Osegueda reiterated in 1999 the impact the slayings had on the community, especially since homicides, particularly a brutal triple homicide, were uncommon in the city. The fact that a three-year-old child was a victim burned the gruesome crime into the minds of residents. In the months following the family annihilation, other murders in the areas surrounding Montwood had residents fearing a connection. The increased homicidal violence in the community was abnormal, and if only for a fleeting moment, it was difficult for residents to prevent their minds from drifting. On February 11, 1995, 29-year-old Cecilia Loya was found savagely bludgeoned to death, another vicious and bloody killing. It wasn't far from where Connie, Frank, and Dante were slain, less than a couple miles north. When interviewed by the El Paso Times, Connie and Frank's next-door neighbor said that she and others in the neighborhood feared a serial killer, a quote, weirdo, as one resident put it. Folks in the area were double-checking that their doors were locked and triple-checking their children at night. They said it had always been so quiet and peaceful in the area, but now everyone was on edge, fearful and stricken by paranoia. On the same day Cecilia Loya's body was discovered, so was the body of 60-year-old Bobby J. Thompson, whose murder remains unsolved, as does the murder of 48-year-old Rafael Vasquez the following April on the 12th. And the killer of an unidentified person found burning in a dumpster in July of 95 also remains at large. Detective David Samaniego commented while reviewing the case in 1999 that detectives usually come up with solid leads and are quick to clear a case. But as far as the murders of Frank, Connie, and Dante are concerned, the department was, quote, totally in the dark. No motive, no suspect. Since Connie's Dodge Colt was found so close to the border, it seems likely that the killer crossed over into Mexico after committing the murders, only further confounding the investigation. Though Detective Samaniego was optimistic about solving the crime when he took it on in 1999, commenting that fingerprints and DNA discovered at the scene were continually ran through databases seeking a match, the slayings of Frank Santoni Thornhill, Connie Villa, and Dante Santoni Villa remain unsolved, and the motive is still undetermined. Maria Teresa, Frank's estranged wife, was out of El Paso at the time of the slayings, visiting her then newly born grandchild. She's wondered since the day the bodies were discovered why the case was so difficult for El Paso police detectives to solve. Maria Teresa and Frank's oldest daughter doesn't know why her father, his girlfriend, and the half-brother she never got to meet were killed, but suggests that the reason might be drug-related. Whether he was a dealer in over his head or a user who owed money, she said, is not clear, if the motive was drug-related. Regardless of why, she still hopes that someone will come forward with information that will solve the case. Connie was most likely a victim of circumstance, as was her son, and the families of both her and Frank wonder, more than anything else, why 3-year-old Dante had to die, his death the most senseless, rendering the perpetrator heartless, depraved, and inhuman. If you have any information about the murders of Francisco Santoni Thornhill, Maria Concepcion Villa, and Dante Villa, please contact the El Paso Area Crime Stoppers at 915-566-8477. If you're interested in more from El Paso, listen to our 3-part series on the disappearances of Margaret and William Patterson, a case perhaps as baffling and unexplained as this one. You can hear our episodes about 2 El Paso killers, too, by donating $2.50 or more a month at our Patreon page. Those episodes are titled The Desert Killer and The Butcher Painter. You can find them at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast, and donors at all levels there get our regular episodes ad-free as well. There are also levels that get you Gone Cold merchandise. We appreciate all of you who donate to our Patreon beyond words. Without y'all, we couldn't produce half the content we do, and both Erica and I are grateful. The El Paso Times was used as a source for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.